did you, I just told Randy where we thought we'd start again, but did you want to ask questions first?
Well, I'll ask questions as it, well, this is the major question I have. You know, I really worked hard trying to integrate something of our last class, right, about how the dollars go over and where they land, and then how they get
brought back
to the other currency.
Currencies, right, and then how they make their way back here, right?
Yes. So let me tell you what's in my head. I don't know if it's not that clear to me at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we have banks and they have deposits of customers. Okay.
Yeah.
And some of those customers, people and corporations and governments, want to buy something from a foreign country or want to pay a bill in a foreign country or, you know, want to do something in a foreign country.
Well, you have to be, when you're going to talk about this stuff, you have to try to be as precise as you can. In other words, here's what I would ask so far. If somebody here wants to buy a foreign product, are they buying it here after it's been imported? Or are they talking to an importer who would bring it in?
No.
Or are they talking to a foreign source?
No, they're talking to the foreigners.
Talking to a foreign party who has an item for sale.
Yeah, because if you buy something in this country, you can always pay dollars for it.
Well, to some degree, mostly, yes, but the... In other words, there is a method, there is paperwork, there is a procedure, legal procedure, by the way, for getting stuff into this country.
Right.
I mean, just because it arrives on a boat doesn't mean that when it's offloaded, it is in this country. It may go to a customs warehouse where it is impounded. And it has to be cleared before it actually gains entry into the United States. And so all of that stuff involves who owns it, when does ownership pass, what is the consideration, meaning money, that is exchanged when those things happen, and all that stuff. Those are all legal procedures.
Yes, and you know, this has cropped up in the history of money, all
mm-hmm.
through history.
Right.
You know, and it's not something that I think most citizens have
right.
any experience with.
Very true.
But it
yep.
does crop up because British ships came in, the Americans went out there to say, what are you bringing into our country, and you know, and do you have to pay, you know, I forget, like, I don't know the
sure.
details, you know.
I do. I've read some of them. In fact, the story of the Boston Tea Party is precisely about this situation.
Oh, tell us.
Oh, my heavens. Well, that was the tax on tea was the one that was retained. They had a tax on legal documents. You know, you had, in order to file a legal document, you had to buy a stamp. You had to buy this, you had to buy that. It had to be this way, it had to not be that way. This was all while we were still colonists, right?
Right.
We were still under the king. Yeah. Okay, so here come the ships, the English East India Company sailing vessels are coming in, sailing into Boston Harbor. Yeah. So here they come. The question is, when have they entered Boston Harbor? You know, does simply the ship arriving and dropping its anchor amount to entry?
But let me ask
into
you,
this?
We're under the British, right? So,
yes.
So the British,
well, yes,
the
British
ones...
governors.
Right.
The governor of Massachusetts,
so the
Hutchinson, or whatever his name was.
Right. So the British are the ones that ask these questions.
Oh, no. No, our we had in Massachusetts at the time, there was a council, the Council of Burgermen or whatever they called it. Well, I can go fetch the book if you want to hear it.
Yeah. This is all like legal, commercial stuff that no one
learns. Well, a little bit about merchant law, because that's what this one woman, this book I was reading.
This is The Life and Public Services of Samuel Adams.
Oh, wow.
I think I could find that, because you talked about that before. I was looking for to get a copy. Maybe I found it on in digital form. I don't know. Anyway.
See if I can find it here. Where do you want to start?
At the beginning.
Yeah.
So.
No. That is too much. Let me sum up. Well, in June to September in the Gazette, this is in Boston, in his correspondence, Adams calls for a Continental Congress, first proposed by him. So Samuel Adams was the first one that proposed a Continental Congress. The Boston Committee of Correspondence, September 21st, this is 1773. The Boston Committee of Correspondence sends to other towns a circular written by Adams advocating an American Confederacy. October 9th, Governor Hutchinson denounces Adams to the ministry as the leader of the town of Boston and manager of the legislature.
Well, hold on there. Adams. Hold on. The Boston something of correspondence, what was that?
Committee of Correspondence.
Now, who were they?
But we're also, the committees of correspondence were originated by Sam Adams as well. He was attempting to improve the correspondence, the communications between the colonies, particularly with Virginia and not so much New York as Maryland and other friends in the South, the Carolinas, as well, and Connecticut. So he was trying to, the committees of correspondence, he tried to get somebody from the friends he knew in those other places to establish in their colonial legislatures committees that would officially communicate the current conditions back and forth.
So wait a minute. So are the committees of correspondence created by those colonial legislatures?
Yes.
Oh,
yep.
I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Huh.
October 9th, 1773, Hutchinson denounces Adams to the ministry as leader of the town of Henry. October 21st, Adams composes for the Massachusetts Committee of Correspondence a letter to the other colonies similar to that sent to the towns in Massachusetts colony. In November, the Patriots attempt to force the agents of the East India Company to resign. Several town meetings are held.
This is Boston?
Yes.
Well, hold on. Who is this agent? Who is he?
Right.
I mean, what's his role?
Well,
is he a legal role?
Yeah, the agent, is that the one that is trying to sell the stuff into the colonies?
Right, yep, they are the agents. As in the other colonies, commissioners had been appointed in Boston to act as agents for the East India Company.
Commissioners?
Active opposition. Sorry?
Commissioners?
As in the other colonies, commissioners, yes.
What is a commissioner?
Well, it's a person who holds a commission.
From the legislature?
Yep. Or from the governor. Remember, this is under the monarchy.
So the agent of the East India Company was a commissioner appointed by the governor of...
Usually, yep.
Oh, okay.
To act as agents for the East India Company. Active opposition commenced in Philadelphia, where on the 18th of October, resolutions were adopted against the duty on tea and requesting the agents of the company to resign, which in a few days they did.
So hold on. So this commissioner representing the governor of the colony, who was the British governor,
Well, Philadelphia was a little different. Philadelphia, of course, was founded by William Penn, Pennsylvania. But was founded by William Penn through the king. Yes, he did have a grant, a commission. He had a warrant, essentially, a grant of land from the king over lands that the king did not own. But nonetheless, he came over here with a piece of paper thinking he had all this stuff, this land granted by the king, so he moved in here. That's where Philadelphia sprang up, right? Pennsylvania. William Penn ran it, but it was essentially founded, William Penn was a Quaker. So Pennsylvania has a little bit different, if you know, in particular, the Pennsylvania is technically known as the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Back then?
Yes, ma'am. Yep.
So there wasn't a royal governor?
Yes, there was. I'll take that back. William Penn was the governor for a long time. He kind of held it personally on his own say-so from his grant by the king, and I think other members of his family took over after him. Or he at least appointed his successor. But all I'm saying here is that Pennsylvania had a little different construction as far as their domestic government, colonial government went, than Massachusetts did.
Okay, let's stick with Massachusetts. Okay.
Yeah.
So the agent for the East India Company, whose boats have just come into Boston Harbor, the agent... appointed by the royal governor, what did he do that made people angry?
Well, it was over the tax on tea, the duty on tea. This was taxation without representation. They were being taxed, or they had to pay a duty to get the tea off the boat to import the tea. They had to pay a duty to the crown, to the king, before they could...
The legislature had to pay it?
No, the merchants.
Oh, the merchants had to pay it.
Oh, the people. People had to pay, yeah. Resulted in an increase in the price of tea. Forced up the price of tea to the tea drinker.
Okay. Inflation.
Well, it's a tax, and yet you didn't get to vote on whether you had a say in raising that tax or not.
Right.
So anyway, what he said here was about Philadelphia, the commissioners resigned. In Boston, this example was followed, and notices were left on the night of the 1st of November at the door of each one of the agents, summoning them to appear at Liberty Tree on the following Wednesday to resign their commissions.
Now, who did that?
There was someone. Let's see. There's a footnote here. It says, as the tea ships were sailing from England, Arthur Lee wrote to Samuel Adams. This is October 13th, 1773. Quote, "The introduction of the tea ought, I think, to be opposed. I enclose you a letter on that subject. The confidence with which the least appearance of safety inspires cowards should make us cautious in permitting administration to succeed in any of their measures. The commodity may, under this maneuver, come cheaper to the consumer the merchant's commission, etc., being avoided. But whatever touches our liberties should under every temptation be shunned. Besides, when once they have fixed the trade upon us, they will find ways enough to enhance the price. But I rest in your wisdom.
Was this the first tax? No.
Not the first, no. No, they had tried all kinds of other taxes, and they roused all kinds of opposition. And finally, Franklin, of course, was serving as an ambassador to the court of St. James. He was over there in London at the time. And so through his efforts in London, they were able to succeed in repealing most of the odious taxes other than the one on tea. Tea was retained as the fly in the ointment. I'm going to stick this in your craw, said the king. Actually, it was the advisors to the king. King didn't really care. Yeah, well, he was having enough problems. He was pissing blue at the time.
What does that mean?
Seriously, his urine was blue. He was ill.
Oh. Wasn't he pretty young, King George?
He was George the Fourth or George the Third is who it was. Not at that time, not during the Revolution. No, he was, 60 years old. Anyway, doesn't matter. Let's see. The meeting was called together by the ringing of church bells for an hour before noon and by the public crier who announced it at the top of his voice. The following notice was posted about the town. To the freemen of this and the neighboring towns, gentlemen, you are desired to meet at the Liberty Tree this day at 12 o'clock noon, then and there to hear the persons to whom the tea shipped by the East India Company is consigned, make a public resignation of their offices as consignees upon oath, and also swear that they will reship any teas that may be consigned to them by the said company by the first sailing vessel to London. In other words, it's going back, boys.
Oh, so it was more than a tax.
Well, it was about the tax. They were saying, you want to charge us a tax on tea? We're going to send your damn tea back to you. We ain't going to let it in. Therefore, we don't owe you any tax.
We're going to be kicked off.
Ah.
Oh, okay, come back in.
Funny about this, the posted circular is that down at the bottom of the posted circular there was a pointing hand, you know, one of those,
right,
that says, show me the man that dare take this down.
Oh, interesting. So they were wanting the resignation of these agents of the East India Company.
You bet.
And they wanted to send the ships back to England with the tea on it.
They wanted both. In other words, they wanted them to publicly resign their offices and to swear that they will reship any teas that may be consigned to them by the first vessel heading back to London.
Were these agents colonials?
Sure. Sure, they were just businessmen. They were traders, international traders. Well, they didn't see it as international trade. They saw themselves as subjects of the king.
Right.
Huh. I'm here.
Ah, okay.
Hi.
So Adams, Hancock, and Phillips, the selectmen, that's the members of the, you know, it's like the governing council of the council.
Is that, like, is the, that of the city now, not of the colony?
Well, I think it was both, but I'm not sure. I'd have to dig back in there and see how they actually arranged it. I don't remember.
But they're colonials.
Yes. Okay. Adams, Hancock, and Phillips, the selectmen, and William Cooper, the town clerk. So this town clerk, with about 500 more, gathered on the appointed day, November 3rd. But as the consignees did not make their appearance, Molyneux and Warren and a body of the people proceeded to Clark's warehouse, where all the agents were assembled. And Molyneux acted as spokesman in the parley which ensued, to the demand which he made by a written paper that they should promise not to sell the teas but return them to England, they gave a point blank and insolent refusal.
These are, okay, so the warehouse is owned by these colonial businessmen who were, are the agents.
Right.
Okay, so they refused.
Yep. The people, the 500 assembled there, would probably then have proceeded to violence had not Molyneux dissuaded it.
Who dissuaded who?
One of the 500 people who got the meeting together.
Okay.
Talked the rest of the folks into not being violent in their, in the face of what they just got refused. The town meeting was held on the 5th. To consider the report that the East India Company were about shipping their teas to this and the other colonies, a political plan of the British administration to establish and fix the tribute laid upon the importation of that article. During the debate, some of the Tories were engaged in circulating a number of printed handbills called the Tradesman's Protest, against the proceedings of the merchants on this subject of the tea importations. The meeting was a public one, though called for a special purpose, and the interference was not only met with the spirit of perfect toleration, but the regular proceedings were stopped, and on motion, one of these papers was read aloud by Paxton, who had been seen distributing them in King Street the day before. After the reading, without comment and giving the document the benefit of the last hearing, the tradesmen present were desired to collect themselves at the south side of the hall when the question was put to them whether they acknowledged the tradesmen's protest, and the whole number, amounting to at least 400, voted in the negative.
Wait a minute, these are the colonial merchants, the tradesmen?
This was the town meeting.
Right, but who are the tradesmen that were collecting?
Well, the tradesmen were protesting the tea and the tax and the whole deal.
So they were colonial businessmen that had would sell the tea?
No, these were the whether they acknowledged the tradesmen, the whole number amounting at least 400 voted in the negative. No, they did not admit, they did not acknowledge the tradesmen's protest. The paper and Paxton and others who had circulated it, as well as its printer, were then denounced as false, base, and scandalous.
I'm confused.
This unanimous vote was a finishing stroke to the protest, about which nothing was ever heard again.
I'm confused, Randy, what the role of these people, what the interests of these people are. These tradesmen, 400 tradesmen at this meeting that voted no to what?
The town meeting was held on the 5th to consider the report that the East India Company were about shipping their teas to this and the other colonies. That's what it was about.
Right.
It was about the agents receiving tea from England and from Boston, shipping it to other colonies. You know, sending the trade on down the coast.
Weren't those ships out running around trying to figure out where to dump that tea? They'd gotten too much from India?
It doesn't say anything about that in this book.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's... But anyway...
So the tradesmen who were protesting at the Liberty Tree or in the town meeting, those tradesmen that were protesting this shipment of tea, they were colonial... Who were they? They were...
Well, during the debate, some of the Tories, those are, you know...
Supporters.
Right. Monarchists. Supporters of the king. That's a Tory.
Right.
During the debate, some of the Tories were engaged in circulating a number of printed handbills called the Tradesman's Protest against the proceedings of the merchants on this subject of the tea importations.
So stop right there. They were against the tea importation, these tradesmen, these Tories.
Yes.
And what, by calling them tradesmen, so they're businessmen in Boston? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so they didn't want the tea.
Didn't look like it to me.
Yeah, why wouldn't they want the tea? You would think it would be the...
Oh, because they were imbued with this idea about taxation without representation.
Okay. But they're still Tories. I thought they split up, and the Tories were going along with what England did.
Well, they did for a while. Some of them did, some of them didn't. It was all pretty fluid at the time. You know, how do you decide where you're going to stand? And yep. That was the question, you know. Where do you stand?
Mm-hmm.
So all these categories like Tories and rebels and all this stuff, you know, these are names made up after the fact to apply to this group or that group.
Okay.
It's not names that folks called themselves at the time, as near as I can tell.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's like, are they going to lose their business? Are they going to lose their lives? Are they going to, you know, not be able to support their family? You know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because all that was involved. I mean, all that was under consideration. You had to think about such eventualities. Let's see here. It was evident that the consignees and people receiving the tea were vacillating between greed and fear and delayed action with the hope of some change in public affairs favorable to their intentions. But the determination of the people was not to be evaded by any subterfuge. The committee had inquired on the previous evening at Elisha Hutchinson's house in Boston, where they ascertained that the persons they sought were at Milton, at the county seat of the governor. On Saturday morning, having called against the house, called again at the house, without meeting the objects of their search, they rode out to Milton, and applying at the governor's residence, were informed that only Elisha Hutchinson had lodged there last night, and that he had set out early that morning for Boston. Anyway, back and forth and back and forth.
So these American colonists, some of them tradesmen, whatever.
Right.
They're trying to figure out how to stop this because the agents of the East India Company, they refused.
Right. Yep. They refused to send the tea back.
Right.
Or resign their commissions. Yep.
Right.
A fast sailing vessel arrived on the 17th from London, having on board one of the East India factors, that's a person of the company, and bringing the news that the tea ships had actually sailed and might soon be expected. The next day, a meeting was held when a committee of citizens, including Samuel Adams, again applied to the several T consignees to know if they would resign their commissions, to which they replied that though they had not yet received any order from the company, their friends in England had entered into penal engagements in their behalf, merely of a commercial nature, which put it out of their power to comply with the request of the town. It's not, I can't decide. It's, I was told. Somebody's telling me what to do. And if I don't do it, I'm up, you know, I may be a criminal if I fail to comply. It's not me, it's them. They're telling me. This answer, like the other, was voted not satisfactory. And the meeting was instantly dissolved without a word of debate. See here. On Sunday the 28th, the Dartmouth sailed up the harbor and came to anchor near the castle. The castle was an island out in Boston Harbor. Still is, by the way. With 114 chests of tea. Despite the rigid New England observance of the Sabbath, the committee, who saw that no time was to be lost, met at once and obtained from Roch, the owner of the vessel, a promise not to enter his ship until Tuesday. Enter his ship.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Right. This is what I was saying. Entry of the ship is a legal procedure. Just because he sailed in and dropped anchor doesn't mean that he has arrived in the port. So entry is a...
This is the captain that they're asking. The public committee is asking the captain not to enter the port.
No, they're asking the owner of the vessel.
The owner... And he's a Bostonian?
Don't know if he's a Bostonian, but he was there in Boston because it says the committee met and obtained from Roch, the owner of vessel, a promise not to enter his ship until Tuesday.
So not to have the ship enter the port?
Legally, yep.
Legally.
Samuel Adams was then authorized to invite the committees of Dorchester, Roxbury, Brookline, Cambridge, and Charlestown to bring their own townsmen to hold a mass meeting with those of Boston on the next morning, which would have been Monday morning.
Who authorized him? The city council?
Yeah, or the colonial...
Legislature, yeah.
The message was sent, and responsive to the call, thousands flocked in from all directions. On Monday morning, the 29th, the following placard appeared. Friends, brethren, countrymen, the worst of plagues, the detested tea shipped for this port by the East India Company is now arrived in this harbor. The hour of destruction or manly opposition to the machinations of tyranny stares you in the face.
How many people were at that meeting?
Thousands.
Thousands.
Every friend to his country, to himself, and posterity is now called upon to meet at Faneuil Hall at 9 o'clock this day, at which time the bells will ring to make a united and successful resistance to this last, worst, and most destructive measure of administration. That was the placard. At the hour appointed, the inhabitants gathered at the Cradle of Liberty. That's Faneuil Hall, by the way. The meeting soon swelled into the largest ever known in Boston, and as the Gazette says, was, quote, for the purpose of consulting, advising, and determining upon the most proper and effectual method to prevent the unloading, receiving, or vending of the detestable tea, unquote. Yada, yada, yada. Williams was chosen moderator of the meeting. Business of the meeting was conducted by Samuel Adams, Hancock, Young, Molyneux, and Warren. An organization having been effected, Samuel Adams arose in the vast assemblage and moved that, quote, as the town have determined at a late meeting, legally assembled, that they will, to the utmost of their power, prevent the landing of the tea, the question be now put, whether this body are absolutely determined that the tea now arrived in Captain Hall shall be returned to the place from whence it came at all events.
So Randy.
Yeah.
Given that history, take it to the present day. A ship from England comes into our harbor.
Yep.
It hasn't landed yet.
It hasn't been admitted, right? Yeah, right.
Legally admitted.
Right, yep.
By some agency of government?
By our customs office.
So that's National Customs Office.
Yes, it's, yes. Congress has the power over international trade.
So there's some office here in New York City called the Customs Office?
That's correct.
Never knew about it.
It'll be a branch office. I mean, the customs. Let's see here. Customs.
So do they get on a boat and go out to the vessel and talk to the captain?
No, generally not, no. They might. Usually they have much better communications today than they did then. They have radios. I'm sure they have internet connections and the whole deal.
Gotcha. But they got to get papers, physical papers?
Yeah, they've got to have authorization. You remember all the big stack up when during COVID out there in San Pedro Harbor, they had all those boats anchored offshore, waiting to get in and offload all those container ships. They had over 100 container ships backed up at the Port of Los Angeles.
So it's still on paper. It's not on...
All the boats have arrived, yeah, but they can't get the paperwork done. Even if they did get the paperwork done at that point, they've transferred it all. It's all under the Department of Homeland Security now. U.S. Customs is.
This happened during COVID? That you were saying that they were stuck in...
When did the Customs, National Customs Office get put under Homeland Security?
As soon as Homeland Security was created, which was, 2001?
Yeah,
it was part of the Patriot Act, wasn't it?
Wow, really?
Yeah. Before that, it was part of the Department of Commerce, I believe.
Wow.
I have. Can I ask my question?
Yeah.
It's going back to the revolution, and I was in trying to understand all of this machination of trade. I'm reading this book about Robert Morris, who was superintendent of finance, okay.
Yeah.
So this guy that wrote it, Robert Morris, he's using a lot of Morris's own letters and stuff, but a bunch of stuff.
Yep.
So he says that he's talking about 1782, the spring of 1782. Morris's office was the front line in the new economic phase of the revolution, but America's economy relied on the sea for food and trade, and Congress was growing in debt. So one of the ways that Morris was financing the revolution, partly by his own money, quote unquote.
Well, yeah. He had to earn that somehow too, so.
Right, probably through
shipping.
Right, and they also, he set up a way I guess they were called privateers, where they'd go out and capture enemy ships and then seize the cargo and resell it or reuse it someplace.
Yeah.
So there was a bunch of different kinds of things, but he's explaining here about that guy, Chaim Solomon. So he's saying long-term plans took a backseat to immediate cash needs. Now that a new loan was coming in from the French, so they got a bunch of loans, which I'd like to know how they got loans, because some of them involved shipments of hard money, you know, trading notes for hard money.
Well, but the notes were promises of us to pay.
Okay. So Morris started to sell bills.
And let me point this out, too, that when they would loan us the money.
Yeah.
That means they would take French francs, pay them to French producers to build stuff to put on ships to send here. So we want the wealth.
Right.
Or so they would take French francs and give them to our ambassador or something to go out in the French countryside and pay people to put stuff on boats to send over here. In other words, the French francs never left France.
Yeah.
But they were issued under our promise to repay them.
Interesting. Okay. There's one more feature here that I thought would be useful to understand. Morris started to sell bills of exchange through his broker, Chaim Solomon. They both ended up in debtor's prison,
right,
eventually.
Right.
When these bills of exchange were sold, it amounted to an individual buying a check written on an account in France,
right,
example, and in remitting hard money to the seller. The rate of these exchanges varied according to people's ability to buy and their interest in owning these checks. For example, a person could buy a check worth $100 for $90. That would be a 10% discount.
In what country? Between the
he's talking about France right now, but whatever other trading partners they had.
Let's be specific, because I get really lost. So you have a trader in the colonies, and you have the French government in France, and they want a French bank. Who's the bill of exchange? Is it a bill of exchange?
No, Morris is selling these bills of exchange through his broker, who is in France. Ian Salomon was in France.
Okay, yeah, but a bill of exchange is just that. A bill of exchange is supposed to be a notated piece of paper that says an exchange happened worth this from the buyer to this, the seller. That's a bill, a piece of paper, a bill of exchange.
Give us an example.
Did you buy anything yesterday down at the store?
I bought some food.
Okay. Then you went in and bought. So there should have been, did you get a receipt?
Yes.
That's a bill of exchange.
Oh.
So these bills of exchange he's selling through Chaim Solomon.
The person to whom you paid the money, Sue.
Right.
Has a record of that transaction.
Right.
Now, if you had said, put it on my bill, and the seller, the store guy, says, okay, I know where you live, and I know that you, as a buying customer, always pay your bill when the time comes due on the bill, then your receipt at that point is precisely a bill of exchange. You got the wealth. He didn't yet get the money, but he knows he will.
Oh, so it's not that I bought some food and gave them cash. That's not a bill of exchange.
Right. No, that's a receipt of an actual transaction. That's not a bill of exchange. Had he offered you the chance to pay it at a later date, that's a bill of exchange.
Oh, okay.
The transaction happened, but half of it has yet to be completed. You got the goods, he didn't yet get the payment.
Okay.
So he can take that bill, and he can go to a bank and say, where his bank account is, by the way, and he can say, look, I have a bill of exchange, and the bank will say, oh, I'll give you 90 cents on the dollar for that.
So that's what they're explaining.
So if he needs, right, if he needs some short cash right away, he can take a 10% discount and give the bill of exchange to the bank, and now when you pay 100% of what's on there, he then has to pay off his advance from that bank at 100%, and the bank makes 10% because the grocer only got 90 cents on them when he sold it short.
Okay.
Right?
Got it.
You got it?
Yeah.
That's a discount. A discounted bill of exchange.
So the bank can sell discounts too when they loan another bank?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what the Fed does at the open market, or not the open market committee, but the Fed window.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. So I was just trying to understand that piece of the, how Morris was doing the financial part.
Right. Yeah. You know.
So what banks was Morris selling bills of exchange to?
They're not talking about the banks. They're talking just about what he, you know, who he was depending on to get funds.
Yeah, and it was tougher at that time because who knows who you know. You know, I can represent to the person I want to give me ready cash, even at a discount. And I can say, well, these are good customers. They always pay by the third of the next month. And the person offering me the discount says, well, you may know them, but I don't. You know, I know you, and sometimes you haven't paid. So don't tell me that you're a good reference on folks who pay. So I may offer you only 86%. Yeah, I give you a 14% discount. You know, so it's a horse trade. How much do you think you can allow to slip through your fingers in the way of a discount to make your ready cash to get you out of the situation you find yourself in right now?
So Jerry, just step me through Morris's bills of exchange, how he used them.
Well, it's saying here, and I'm like, he picks this subject up in other parts of this section. So I don't know how clear this is going to be, but in this particular paragraph, which I thought gave more details than the other parts, Morris started to sell bills of exchange. So he's trying to find immediate cash. He needs immediate cash.
Right.
Because everybody, the states won't pay, you know, their taxes, and they said they wanted to participate in this war, but they didn't want to offer any support to the continental government.
So hold on. So he has these bills of exchange because he has delivered goods to people that gave him the bills, signed bills of exchange.
Apparently, he's not right here, but yeah, that's got to be.
There's another possibility, and that is that maybe he either accepted already discounted bills of exchange, or he may have promised delivery and entered into a transaction thinking that he will soon be in possession of the goods to make delivery. See, it'll work on both ends, both the giving and the receiving. You can discount or offer premiums either way. So you never know. That's the experience of the businessman, is to try to keep those things kind of at least in your head, so you kind of have an idea of where your short spots are going to wind up next Tuesday.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
But mm-hmm. This is all in American, it's not between currencies, what Morris is doing.
Well,
yeah, it was.
At that time, yeah, because if it crossed a colonial boundary, we didn't have Well, we had Continentals in 1782.
But the states still regarded themselves as nation.
Right. Yep, as well, as monetary authorities.
Yeah.
But I was just trying to point that it, I was hoping, you know, it will give us a little bit more insight into, you know, what we're talking about in peak, actually.
Right, so. Yeah.
So it's like a piece, a security paper. You know, it's like, oh, I'll buy that from you, but I'm not going to buy it at full price. I'll, you know, give you this.
Yep, 90 cents on the dollar, you know. Yeah, that's like this... what is it? Oh, Bed Bath & Beyond stocks. At one time, they were worth about $80 a share or something like that, $50 a share, whatever it was. Today, it's less than a dollar a share. And what they're trying to do right now is to try to do a reverse stock split where they actually concentrate several shares into one share so they can get the share price back up above a buck a piece.
Well, huh.
Yeah, well, thinking that they can then use that to keep themselves out of bankruptcy.
Well, AMD, several years ago, during the 2008 crash, they were, you know, the Intel chip, AMD.
AMD is Advanced Micro Devices.
Yeah. So their stock went down to, like, it almost became a penny stock.
Right.
Now it's back up there. It's worth a few dollars. Did they go through machinations like that, or was it the government or something else?
I have no idea whether they did or not. Probably what happened was that they either got into an agreement with somebody else, they sold some of their patents, perhaps. They were always known for reverse engineering Intel chips. That's what they did. They had a set of engineers that they would buy a new Intel chip, put it through its paces, and try and determine the performance parameters and the capabilities of the chip, and then write a list of what that stuff was and give it to the engineers, and their engineers on the other side of what's called the Chinese Wall would take their list of parameters and build a chip that did that. And that way they couldn't be accused of infringing on Intel's patents because they had not copied Intel's stuff. All they did was figure out what they were doing and make it happen on their own.
So if you had, you know, monetary reform, parity for farms and equitable trade, would that kind of thing, those kinds of incentives and practices go by the wayside and kind of shrivel up and die?
Well, I don't know that parity would make that stuff disappear. I think what would make it disappear is the fact that with a parity exchange working, people become less inclined to worship money.
Yeah, well, okay.
So it takes that idolatrous nature out of the social interaction. And people's grubbing for top dog, dog eat dog, devil take the hindermost, whatever the market will bear, all that kind of crappy thinking finds less and less footing in our everyday social interactions. There just isn't a call for it. There's no need. How come, you know, you don't need to crush me for you to get ahead?
Right.
You know, we're in this together, not in spite of each other. That's what I look for. It's a lessening of, all competition, cutthroat competition, which is where we are at today, results in crappy products manufactured down to a price, which is the very opposite of what we deserve and what we should be expecting, which is the very best of everything everybody can do.
Right. And I think the normal person thinks he is and wants to supply that kind of product.
Yep. Yeah. And instead we have planned obsolescence and we have fashion. Ooh, fashion.
all this gobbledygook, all these reasons to explain what's going on and make excuses and all kinds of it's kind of getting in the way of
It's very much getting in the way. It's getting in the way of cogent thinking. It's getting in the way of good social relationships. It's getting in the way of our own best impulses. It's getting in the way of good government. I mean, good Lord.
I know, good Lord is right.
Look at the way those people were treated in the Tennessee legislature. Right? It's just appalling.
What people?
Well, they kicked out two legislators yesterday.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
What'd they do?
Well, they kept trying to bring up on the floor of the Tennessee House of Representatives a debate on gun control. And I'm sure they had their desired positions. But nonetheless, every time they sought recognition from the chair and approached the well of the House to speak, as soon as the words came out of their mouth about what it was they were going to speak on, the Speaker of the House would turn off the microphone.
I've seen that happen.
So this had happened at several times during the week. And so finally, on Friday, Thursday, maybe it was Wednesday, I don't know. Anyway, three of them, actually. There was two men and one woman. Two guys were black. Woman was white. They kind of got together and planned out what they were going to do. What they did was they finally sought recognition again, got recognized, went down to the well of the House. And as soon as they turned off the microphone again, the guy had a bullhorn. So he pulls out his bullhorn and he starts talking to the membership through the bullhorn.
Good for him.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, this was considered a breach of decorum in the House. And they took the committees met and took up all three, the two black men and the one woman, white woman, and they decided whether or not they were going to expel them from the House. And they expelled the two black legislators, and by one vote, they did not expel the white woman.
Oh, boy. Oh, my God. I guess
I'm not fond of gun control legislation. I have my own thoughts on that, but nonetheless, to throw somebody up for a breach of decorum, sure, that'll work. old white guys got nervous. They got pissed off is what they were. They got pissed off. We're going to show you, you sons of bitches. Watch this. We're going to throw your ass out of here. And they did. Bah. See? We're still in control. Ha, ha, ha.
Right.
Well, it's censorship.
We're going to be kicked off again. We're ready to be kicked off, guys.
Okay, give me 1 minute. I'll make up a new meeting and send it.
Oh, you have to use a new meeting?
Yeah.
We can't just log back in on this one?
Well, hopefully they give me the same, try it. Okay. I gotta go do it.
Yep.
Hey, Sue.
Hi. They gave me the same. That was good.
Yeah. Hey, Randy.
It worked.
Yep, it worked.
Look at that air.
So, we're already an hour in. Should we start with our book?
Let's do the peak.
haven't even gotten to the book yet.
We can go back to all this other paper, you know, bills of exchange another time, because...
Right.
Well, if that's, you know, it does play into this, because this is, you know, this is how the, when you do foreign exchange, the currency never leaves the local, I mean, some of it does. Sure, but the volume of transactions conducted around our planet in dollars is way, way, way beyond the amount of dollars that are actually physically in existence. It's all just representations in computer memory. You know, it's promises on paper. That's what it comes down to. So, at the time that Peak was writing this stuff here, all of this was very, what shall we say? This was 1936, this book was written. It's only 2 years into the U.S. going off the domestic gold standard. Gold had just been devalued from $20.67 an ounce to $35. And when then it was confiscated.
Yeah. Took away the people's gold.
And so this was all very new here. So the ability to render these numbers that he's doing was really, it was helpful, but it wasn't necessarily connected in Peak's head or anybody else's head at that time on what the domestic implications are for losing a reference standard like gold or changing it. So it kind of puts all the numbers into sort of a cocked hat. How do you evaluate what the numbers really mean? And yet he was absolutely correct in saying that without knowing the numbers, you can't know what a proper policy is.
You would think.
And that's what he's trying to help determine here. Was how to, that was one of the things I was pointing out to Mike White. He was trying to figure out how come Peak, what was his question here? I forget now. Let's see, it's one of these later ones. I guess it was this one here. He was puzzled, Mike White's puzzled as to why Peak seems not to have said anything about the actual parity program from 42 to 43.
But the book was published before.
Well, yes, this book was published in 36, right. But, you know, he's speaking generally as the, in other words, how come Peak didn't step up to the microphone during the war to talk about the parity program as Wilkin and Ray and Coulter and the NASDA group were able to get it shepherded into operation during the war? How come Peak didn't step forward and say something about it? That's the way I took his question. And I said, as far as I know, Peak was still trying to work with this export-import bank deal. And so when he saw the parity stuff going on under Wilkin and the guys at NASDA and stuff, he probably had no problem with it at all. He probably figured, oh, those guys got a pretty good handle on it. Good, they can go after that. I'm going to try and keep working on this thing here. I don't know. No, I've got no idea.
Let me ask another question. Okay, so here's Peak. He's getting these figures.
Yep.
So my understanding so far, and again, this is, you know, I'm struggling with this international accounts and stuff.
Yep.
So the money, some money goes out of our country, to foreign countries.
Yeah.
And so it's sitting as it, and this I got from reviewing the Indian professor talking about the foreign exchange market. So you can have, in a foreign country, you can have a bank, like the professor said, 90% of all the transactions go through banks, right? You can have the bank have a customer account that's denominated in U.S. dollars.
Right.
Now that to me means that the central bank of that country, which creates the reserves, they have an account with those U.S. dollars in the their reserve account. No?
No, it doesn't require that. It depends on their banking laws. I have no idea what's required. One of our norm members, Tony Birney, used to live, he's died now, he passed on, but he lived in Forest, Ontario. I've been over his house a couple of times. I used to visit him. I love Tony dearly. But he had and would send me annual dues checks from his checking account, Bank of Canada. And on the bottom of the check, when I would receive it, it said, U.S. dollar account. But all that means is that when they transfer that money, they've already assigned the exchange rate to calculate his balance.
Wait a minute. Whose account is it coming from? His account.
His account.
Yep. In a Canadian bank.
Yep.
So
he had to go down there and talk to him and say, I want to establish a U.S. dollar denominated account for the business that I want to do in the U.S.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yep.
You can go to France and mm-hmm. there can be, in French banks, U.S.
Sure.
denominated dollar accounts.
That's right.
Right. And those
right.
banks...
Well, they're
those
probably banks, Euro accounts now. But.
Right, right. And those banks, they go... Because I saw this at Citibank. I threw away the documentation. But when I found it at Citibank, I wasn't working on this system, but I came across
right.
it. They have a trading system at Citibank for mm-hmm. their customers that need foreign currencies. And they go into
right.
the foreign currency market, and they buy
sure.
and sell for their customers.
Yeah, well, that's what it's called, is buying and selling.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
it's still just chips in a memory chip.
Yes, but it's denominated
yeah.
in a different currency other than the dollar currency.
Well, it flows through that, yeah. They calculate
yeah.
an exchange ratio, that's all they're doing.
Yeah, but it's denominated as the foreign currency.
Yeah, they're picking the standard. Yeah, we're going to choose the U.S. dollar as the standard for valuing the numbers in this account, yeah.
Right, and so knowing that there are these kinds of accounts in banks around the world,
mm-hmm.
that helps me.
Okay.
And, you know, I could be a customer of Citibank and say, hey, you know, I have $200,000 of French franc in my French franc account. I want to turn
right.
them into dollars, and they'll go out and trade it and
mm-hmm.
tell me how many dollars I'm going to get.
Right.
And, of course, they make
Absolutely.
A fee.
Yeah, and in fact, what I discovered was that I went down to deposit one of Tony's checks. This only happened in the last two or three times that I received his check. Up until that point in time, for 20 years, there had never been a problem at all. But the last two or three times, Tony passed on in 2009, I forget now. Anyway, the last two times I cashed his check, the credit to the account, the norm account, didn't happen for 3 months at a time.
Wow.
And so I tried to track it through and find out where it was being held up. And what I discovered was that all foreign checks, all foreign checks in the United States pass through the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank.
Why would that be?
Yeah.
Just a...
That's their rule. Their current rule, or it was current at that time. They probably changed it now. Who knows? I got no idea.
And your bank, all you saw in your bank were U.S. dollars.
Yes. Yeah, but I couldn't get the credit out of that check for 3 months. And in fact, what they did was they put a hold on it, and then they charged me extra for the exchange rate.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's how they make their money.
It was already denominated in U.S. dollars.
But I thought you said differently.
No, it was a denominated U.S. dollar account, said right on the check. U.S. dollar account on a Canadian bank. But because it was a Canadian bank, it had to go through the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank. And that means that they had to mail it.
So what he did was he created an account that was dollar denominated. It was a special account.
Yep.
So that he could write a check for dollars, in dollars.
Right.
And then that goes through the Atlantic Federal Reserve.
Well, it came through the mail to me. I deposited my independent bank down here. They sent it to the clearinghouse. The clearinghouse sends it to the Atlanta Federal, well, probably went to the Chicago Federal Reserve first. They had to then send it to the Atlanta Federal Reserve because all foreign checks get cleared through the Atlanta Federal Reserve. They have to do the accounting there, and then they do whatever they do, the magic, and then backwards through the system, it takes 3 months to get it all the way through and then back so that it gets credited in my local account.
Anything more convoluted? So,
and the there,
I can guarantee you, I can guarantee you that if Donald Trump wanted to cash a Canadian check, it wouldn't take 3 months to clear.
But let me ask again, the amount of money that you got into your account was the same as his check?
No.
And what reason was given to you?
It was a foreign check. It was an extra processing fee.
Oh, okay.
And then $20 right off the top.
$20? Wow!
Out of a $100 check.
And then when they sent this, that money from the account to Chicago and all the other places, they were just sending digits on a screen. They weren't mailing stuff.
I don't know.
Okay.
I had to allow them the fact that they actually put postage stamps on it just to account for all the time it took. But I don't know. No, it's just punitive. It's kind of like enforcing the jaywalking statutes, you know. How many people are the two legislators that got kicked out of the Tennessee House, you know? They've had people in that house that have actually been convicted of crimes that have never been expelled. And simply because these two guys got up there and started talking through a bullhorn and embarrassed the poor, dumb son of a bitch that tries to run the place. I watched his head explode. Yeah. Well, it's selective enforcement. You know, it's how many laws have you broken today? You know, we've got laws enough that everybody could be in jail forever if they were all enforced on the behavior that everybody commits every day.
Can I start to read Peak where we left off?
I challenge you.
Page 226, at the bottom of the list, our so-called investments fall into three classes.
Yes.
Okay, so he just said there were these foreign investments from our country, right?
That's right, yep.
Worth $2 billion.
$22 billion. Oh, the $2 billion is just foreign investments here.
So you take away the foreign investments here.
Foreign securities and investments in foreign countries. In other words, foreign securities held by our citizens and investments by our citizens in foreign countries is $14.398 billion. War loans is $10.304 billion. The total of that is $24,702. Foreign investments here, in other words, people from outside our country who have invested their purchasing power here, is just over $2 billion.
Oh, okay.
So the net is $22.645 billion.
So those
our so-called investments fall into three classes.
So that he's talking about the $22.645 billion.
I think he's talking about, well, he's going to break this down into the three things there, yes. In other words, the first one he talks about, number one, direct investments abroad, which would be on line one, which is both foreign securities and investments in foreign countries. So he's talking about direct investments abroad.
He's talking, wait a minute. Wait, I have to go slower, Randy.
The first line with a number. Read it. Foreign securities and investments in foreign countries, right?
Right above.
So he's talking about that $14 billion.
Part of that. That is the sum of two portions, foreign securities and investments in foreign countries.
Okay, so these are the three classes. He's breaking it down into three classes.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. I did not get that.
Okay.
Okay, let me do something here. Okay. Direct investments abroad. That is American plants located on foreign soil and investments by Americans in foreign plants.
Right.
These had a book value at the end of 1933 estimated at $7.7 billion. However, this estimate was based on a 1929 Department of Commerce questionnaire, and there has been no reappraisal.
Right.
The American factories abroad, employing as they must foreign workmen, are to be considered not as a part of the American system, but as in competition with American products made in America. In part, therefore, our foreign trade has been used to finance the making abroad of goods formerly made in America.
Exactly. In other words, we're helping them buy the bats they are using to beat our brains out with.
Right. Very un-American.
Well, in your opinion, you're not an international banker.
Right.
What's the matter with you?
Two, the war debts. So that's the second line, $10 billion. Okay. Amounting to $10.304 billion. The entirety of this debt,
except for a small amount owed by Finland.
So this is the debt of the Europeans to us.
World War One.
The entire.
Yeah, you wrote a paper about all that money.
Yes. That's why I'm asking.
Yep.
The entirety of this debt, except for a small amount owed by Finland, is in default and for the time being represents just so much wealth lost.
Lost.
Okay. He's good.
Pissed away. Given away. Thrown to the wind.
Right. Three, the balance of the debt is represented by securities issued by foreign nations and their political divisions and by foreign corporations, which at the end of 1933 were estimated at $6 billion. Now, where is that, $6 billion?
Well, that's not... That's... Well...
See,
no, that's an intermediate figure, that $6 billion.
That's part of the $10
billion?
Yeah, probably, right?
Balance of the debt. Well, no, he's talking about I thought he was talking about the war debt, but that's maybe I'm wrong.
No, and two, he says the war debt amounts to $10 billion, except for a bit owed by Finland, and it's in default for the time being represents just so much wealth loss. The balance of the debt, so.
Well, that's what I, balance of foreign nations and their beliefs dominated by foreign corporations. That's the foreign securities part. In other words, up here in number one,
yep.
$7,767,000,000.
Yep.
Loss number three, $6,032,000,000. Add those together and you get what? $14,398,000,000.
Okay.
Which is up there on that first line.
Got you.
Or somewhere close to that, something like that.
So number one and number three together.
Yeah, because that's foreign securities. I think that's number three. Securities issued by foreign nations. So that would be the foreign securities part. Because number one talks about the investments in foreign countries, which is what in number one there. And the foreign securities part is in number three. And number two is the war loans.
Gotcha. So that's the, so number three is the foreign securities, the balance of the debt, securities issued by foreign nations, political divisions, foreign corporations. Okay. So
yep.
Almost half of it.
Yeah.
So a debt, a security issued by a foreign nation is, give me an example.
Say again?
Give me an example of a security issued by a foreign nation.
A security issued by a foreign nation would be like a French bond purchased by an American banker.
Or sold on the bond market here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or a British bond, a British bank bond.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so that's the securities that Americans bought.
Yeah.
Foreign securities.
Securities issued by foreign nations and their political and by foreign corporations. Yep.
So when
these are held by our citizens and institutions, and more than $2 billion are already in default.
Right. So when our American citizens bought them on the bond market, they paid with American dollars, which had to go over and somehow be translated into the foreign money.
Yeah, again, those are just promises on paper that
right.
I will pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Here is a summary of the debt transactions as given in my report of August 30th, 1934. The gross investments by the United States in foreign securities, loans to foreign governments, including the war debts, other investments during this 38-year period. So this is us going into debt to foreigners.
Yep.
$36.8
billion. Yep.
And this
7/8.
Is 38-year period. Okay. As against this sum, there were repurchased, redeemed, and allowed as commissions, discounts, the following. So this is coming back.
Right, yep. Or written off, yes.
Coming back into our country, which...
Well, a discount is a writing off of so much.
Right. Okay.
A devaluing, yeah.
Resulting in a net increase of, there's the $24.7
billion. Right.
Okay. During the 38-year period, the world bought from us U.S. securities. Wow. $11
billion. Mm-hmm.
So that's...
Well, what did they use to buy those? The money that we'd promised to pay them for their stuff. So that, again, never left here. We just wrote it off as a balancing entry and whoop-de-la, there it sits.
Yeah, but you say we wrote it off. You know, this is what I'm confused about, the mechanisms of who's doing all the bookkeeping there.
And what he's saying here is that nobody had been doing the bookkeeping until he wrote it down.
Yeah, someone was doing the bookkeeping and making money off of it.
Well, they were doing enough bookkeeping that they made sure they were not getting taken. Beyond that, they didn't care.
Right. They weren't.
And the government, who's watching?
No, well, it's not our job. Totally agree. They were there to make their buck. Right. So these accounts were lodged in the banks, and they were going back and forth across the ocean, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
Okay. During the 38-year period, the world bought from us securities, etc., of $11 billion. During that period, we bought or redeemed U.S. securities.
Held in foreign countries.
Right.
Of $9 billion.
So there was a net increase in foreigners' investments. There's the two. Okay.
$2 billion. Which amount? Deducted from the net increase in United States loans of that was the $24 billion up above there.
Right.
So you subtract 2057 from 24702, and you wind up with investments where it makes up the net increase in debt for the 38-year period mentioned in my report of May 23rd, 1934, of $22,645,000,000.
And whose debt is it?
The net increase in United States loans and investments in foreign countries. The net increase in debt. Well, it's the net increase in the debt position of the United States with respect to the world.
Okay. Right. They owe us this.
Well, they owe somebody here this.
Yeah,
some of it's private securities. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Europe or the world? He's thinking mostly Europe, isn't he?
Well, that's where we do the most of the business, the exchange business.
Back then, yeah. Someone else want to read?
In a section of comments attached to the second report, I made these observations, which are of importance, because what happened in 1931 may happen again. Or, as will later appear, the country is being engineered around to much the same position it had in 1931. Here are the pertinent paragraphs. We have found it impossible to realize upon many of our foreign investments. Realization means they're in either to recoup the value or to earn a profit.
Or they're in default, right?
Foreign bonds expressed in dollars were not readily marketable outside of the United States. Our foreign direct investments were non-liquid. War debts had been funded on the basis of annual repayments. Finally, as a result of the German and other standstill agreements and exchange restrictions in various countries, only a limited withdrawal was possible of our short-term funds in foreign countries. And here he breaks it down. United States short-term banking funds in foreign countries. 1929, end of. $1.6 billion. Increase in 1930 of $185 million. Decrease in 31, half a billion. Decrease in 32, $186 million. Increase in 33, $29 billion. Net decrease is $535 million, which subtracted from 1617 means the balance in foreign countries, end of year, December 1933, over $1 billion.
And that represents U.S.
Those are short-term banking funds. That might actually be some cash there.
And this is denominated in U.S. dollars.
Yeah. On the other hand, foreign countries realized upon their holdings in our markets and withdrew short-term banking funds as follows. Foreign short-term banking funds in the United States, $3 billion, $37 million. The decrease in 30, well, it was $300 million. Decrease in 31, decrease in 32, decrease in 33. Total decrease, $2.5 billion. Balance in the United States, end of year, December 33, $487 million. So they got all their money out of here.
And they did that by selling it on our market, our bond market, or stuff?
Yeah, whatever it took. Okay. The withdrawals by foreigners of $2,550,000,000 short-term banking funds were responsible for the heavy inroads upon our gold stocks from September 31 to June 32 inclusive. The withdrawal of this gold demoralized our banking system. The consequent pressure exerted by bankers to liquidate loans shattered prices. This situation was accentuated by interest defaults on many foreign bonds, accompanied by correspondingly low market prices. The capital movements for 22 to 29 inclusive indicate that we ourselves made available to foreigners the funds which made possible in later years their withdrawal of our gold. With no responsibility for our national welfare, these investments were thrown on our market, converted into short-time balances, in turn into gold, and withdrawn at the most critical period.
So our gold was going overseas.
Well, I hesitate to say our gold. It's just gold.
Okay, gold.
The gold was used under this regime up through 34. Gold was used to settle those current account.
The gold held in deposits, Fort Knox or banks or
wherever. Right. Yep. Yep.
Well, hold it. Those balances were in the central banks.
Yeah, well, yes, the French Bank, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Although you can rest assured that if there was gold in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, as well, when was Fort Knox actually established?
Yeah, I don't know. You should know. I've heard it so many times.
United States Bullion Repository. It is adjacent to the United States Bullion Depository.
What is?
Fort Knox.
No.
That's the Treasury's gold?
Operated by the United States Department of the Treasury. Treasury built the depository in 1936.
They built it. So this is a period that what's his name, McFadden, is talking about gold leaving the country to build Germany in.
Probably. Yes.
So the banks are. It demoralized the banking system. Why?
Yep.
How was it?
Liquidity. How do you, that's the, if you've got a pile of this stuff sitting in the basement, then you can promise all kinds of people based upon your own experience as a banker of how often you have to call upon that repository to settle any particular account. You know how often that happens, which is not very often. So you can use that as a pool of liquidity to balance your position against anything else that the bank might have to come to face. So it's another balancing task. Am I too far extended? Am I not? What if the winds of planetary economics suddenly go blunk and, you know, whatever. You know, how badly exposed am I if this should happen or that should happen? Contingency planning. And, you know, that's the banker's business. And so you have an idea, if you've got that much on hand as a stopgap measure for handling your obligations, promising to handle your obligations, then you're in strong shape, as they say. We're in, what do they say? We're shockproof today. By making it possible for the gold to go out of the country by getting in debt to the rest of the country so that they can return their dollars holdings here and take gold. That was, that, as far as I'm concerned, that was intentional on the part of the Federal Reserve masterminds. Because by doing that, they can ensure that what they whisper in the ears of the Secretaries of Treasury goes. Because they hold the ability to apply pressure from outside on the U.S. economy.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Yikes and wow.
Well, that's, yep, that is precisely what they're after. It's fait accompli today.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Complete.
For sure.
Well, we're going to be, in 1933, okay, the gold was only stopped domestically for exchange.
But correct. It continued
in
34. Yeah.
34. But it continued
internationally.
So the Treasury had to have gold for if you know, a ship came in and wanted the gold for their.
You see, it had to be written into a contract. In other words, this was what Roger Sherman faced, that caveat against injustice back in 1763 or whenever he did that thing, that little book. Did you ever read that?
No.
A caveat against injustice?
I think I tried to plow my way. His language was really...
Oh, it's tough to read, yeah, but it's not very long.
Right. You sent it around. It's in our file somewhere, Sue.
Yeah.
What's the name of the author?
Roger Sherman. A Caveat Against Injustice, 1752.
We're going to be kicked out.
Roger Sherman Society, in fact, has it.
Do we want to come back for a few more minutes?
No, it's getting...
If what is used as a medium of exchange is fluctuating in its value, it is no better than unjust weights and measures, both which are condemned by the laws of God and man.
Exactly.
That's what Roger Sherman said.
That's a good one. That's a good quote. Add that to your treatise.
Okay, guys, we should say goodbye because we're going to get kicked off.
Yep.
Are we coming back?
I don't know.
Oh.
Do we want to?
It's up to you.
I have to absorb what we just did.
Oh, okay. All right.
I made a tape of it. I'm going to listen to it.
Next week?
You go, girl.
Yes.
Next week.
Saturday?
Yeah.
One
Saturday
Easter.
Or Sunday. I don't know which. Sunday will work for me next week.
Oops. Okay, Sunday's good for me. Whichever, Sue.
Okay. Let's decide by email because we're going to be kicked off.
Thank you.